Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. The history of Zionism is wide and complex, entwined in the history of many peoples and states, and extends over a relatively long period, writes scholar Sabri Girgis, our guest today. His new book, The Foundations of Zionism, which we're going to be talking about, quote, is essentially the inner story of Zionism, starting from the reasons for its emergence and spread, through its proponents and ideology in its various stages, its organizations, parties, and institutions, and ending with its efforts to control Palestine and the region, which culminated in their first and primary phase in the establishment of Israel. Of course, it was also necessary to complete the picture to follow international and Arab conditions that enabled or allowed Zionism to achieve a large part of its goals, he writes. Girgis served in the Palestine Liberation Organization as director of its research center. He was a member of the Palestine National Council and the Fatah Advisory Council, and he was an advisor to Yasser Arafat on Israeli affairs. Sabri is the author of The Arabs in Israel, published in 1966. And in 2025, he was the recipient of the Arab Historian Award from the Union of Arab Historians. He joins us from Galilee in the northern Palestine, along with his daughter, Fida Girgis. Sabri and Fida, it's so good to see you and to have you here on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, Sabri, let's begin with your book, The Foundations of Zionism. It was first published as a series of volumes in 1977 and in 1986. And this is the first time it's been compiled and translated into English, which was done by your daughter, Fida. And it's a meticulous chronicle of the historic origins of the Zionist movement and Zionism as a political ideology. And in fact, the first 200 pages or so of the book dives into just the first few decades of the European Zionist project, decades before the establishment of the State of Israel. And then it moves into the political mechanics of Zionism in the early 20th century, that, of course, culminated in the Nakba in 1948, which you lived through as a young boy. Can you talk about your research and your scholarship of Zionism and how you documented this this ideology?
First of all, I am part of this ideology. I was 10 years old when this Empire of Israel was established. And from that, from the first day that this state was established until today, I am following it closely in all aspects. So this is part of my life. Now, as for my studies, I finished my elementary school here in Fasuta, and then the high school at Nazareth, the monastic school, a dormitory school, a boarding school, and then I went to the Hebrew University, and I graduated from the Faculty of Law. So I got a good knowledge of all the aspects of Israeli life, activity, history, and so on. And since I had a strong feeling of what has happened to the Palestinians, I started studying this movement slowly and slowly. Because, of course, being a graduate of the Hebrew University and knowing Hebrew good, I could easily follow it in all of its aspects. I mean, Hebrew, English, Arabic, everything. And that's so it was not difficult for me to follow it up. And even today, it's not difficult. So this is not, for me, this was not a challenge at all. It was so easy to do it.
And, you know, I mean, it's so granular, all of this this material that you've collected over the decades. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the the process, actually, I want to bring Fida into this conversation too, because translating it into English, having all of this wealth of knowledge and going through the archives and producing really this compilation of the documents of how Zionism was established and what it has inflicted on Palestinians and people across the region, I think is incredibly critical at this moment. Fida, I was recently listening to a conversation between you and Nick Estes of the Red Nation podcast, and you were talking about how in the process of translating your father's book, The Foundations of Zionism, you felt like it was watching a horror film and knowing how it ends. The history of this project from its inception in Europe to the Balfour Declaration to the British Mandate period and then culminating in the Nakba is a horror story. It's expulsion, it's dehumanization, it's about the domination of someone else's land. Can you talk about what it was like?
Look, let me just remind you, when I wrote this book, there was no AI. Okay? There was no internet. And I had to collect the material from books all around from the libraries. Is that okay? You could find nothing on the internet. There was no internet at all. And still, you know, I've spent too much time until I collected it and read it and made it. It's okay. And Fida, in translating it again, did the same thing. And not only that, she forced me to read the translation twice. The first time when she finished the translation, and she really did a great effort to make it. And the next time when the editor, the publisher edited, and I had to pass over it again. So, I mean, the facilities which researchers have now, how to get material on the internet, through AI and so on, we didn't have it at all. It was very difficult, a very tedious job that we have done.
Yeah, I mean, it is... It's kind of unimaginable for someone, you know, of the younger generations. You must have spent so many years, you know, in the stacks of libraries and in, you know, these, yeah. Fida, talk about what the process was like in translating this and working with your father in the, you know, these mountains of research that he has done since the 1960s.
Thank you very much, Nora, and thank you for having us today. It's an honor to be with you on Electronic Intifada. Actually, I want to make the two points. The first one is the one that my father mentioned. I was really amazed, really, during the process of translation. And all the time, this memory kept coming to my mind of when I was a small child in Beirut. My father had the habit of putting little yellow pieces of paper or cards, those white square small cards, inside the pages of books that he was reading. And only later now, in retrospect, did I understand he was actually putting reference points along all these books. Because as he said at the time, of course, he was doing all of this manually. This was one thing that very much struck me when we worked on this translation, the depth of material in the book and how tedious, as he said, it was to actually collect, compile, and then present this in a logical fashion in the way that he did. This was the first thing. About the material itself, what struck me the most was in following the progression of the Zionist movement and finding out all this information, which actually to this detail before reading my father's book, I didn't know, was the fact that in all of this time, the way the Zionist movement came about, it completely ignored and didn't see the presence of anybody else on this land. And in a way, you know, going back to your phrase, a horror show, all of the plans, all of the immigration to the country, everything that was set up was done as though nobody existed in it. And this was the disbelief that I carried really from the beginning to the end. You know, there's only one place in the book where it's mentioned that one of Herzl's aides, you know, found out and rushed up to him. And he said to him, "We're making a big mistake. There are Arabs on the land," and so on. It was really just an afterthought. And this, to a large extent, explains the situation we're in today. Because there was never any consideration given to the true impact of this project.
Yeah, I think that's a component that's, you know, and Sabri, you talk about this, you know, these foundational myths of Zionism. Can you walk us through some of these foundational myths, and talk about how, you know, it was a process that was created. You know, there are various factors in the invention of Jewish Zionism, but it was created, and that implies that it is a process that can be engineered in reverse. How was Zionism created, and do you see a possibility of it being unlearned?
As it is not locked, the Zionists would like to present their movement as if it was, you know, eternal, as if it was always with the Jews since they were born, which is a very big lie. For example, from the day from 73-70 after death until 1900, all in all, there were something like 50,000 Jews in Palestine for 18 centuries. The Jews never came to Palestine. Now, when they suffered under the Tsars in Russia and they had to immigrate there because the Russian government persecuted them, as they had a big ratio in the revolutionary movements. 2 million of them went to the United States, and 1% of the immigrants came to Palestine. Now, it's so clear, very well known, and I mean, you can find it everywhere. This Zionist movement is simply a colonialist movement, no more and no less. And it couldn't be otherwise, because it was formed and it was developed and it grew up in the second half of the 19th century, I mean 1850 and onwards. From 1850 to 1900 in the 19th century, it was the peak of European colonialism. By 19,000, the European powers were already controlling all of Asia and Africa, the two continents. All of them, all states or entities there, or people, whatever. I mean, imperialism was everywhere. And in this atmosphere in which the Zionism crystallized, it couldn't be otherwise. There was then, at those days, there was no self-determination, no independence, no the right of people to do for themselves, etc., etc. All of these things are new things. Then it was colonialism, no more and no less. And you find it in all of their writings. I find it everywhere in all of them. They were roaming around, their leaders in Europe, trying to make contacts with the princes and the kings and the rulers of Europe to ask them, to give them, to help them to make a state in Palestine for the exchange that they will be agents for Europe to defend, let's say, against the savage Arabs or the savage East. And I am sorry to say, that's what they are doing today in their collaboration with His Excellency Trump, fighting Iran and attacking Lebanon and attacking Palestine, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's so clear. I mean, it's so clear. You don't need any you know, any more efforts to find it. They write it everywhere in all of their writings. And there is something good about them. In fact, very good. There was no one single Zionist leader that didn't read anything in writing, either books or pamphlets or articles, everybody, okay? All of them, they write too much, they talk too much. And I have passed over all those writings. I didn't take the sources from somebody who is commenting on them. I read their own articles and books and pamphlets, and all of them, they say it this way. Just, it is a colonialist, imperialist movement, you know, aggressive, exclusive, just it wants everything for itself, and that's all.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the most startling aspects of this, is how, you know, overt and obvious and proud they were, especially in those old days, you know, during the Zionist Congress and during the first few, you know, visits to Palestine, where they were setting up these designs on the land. They were bragging about what their plans were, and they still are bragging about what their plans are. You know, there's this the notion. Yeah,
you are right. Look, for example, they want relations with everybody in the Middle East, except the Palestinians. They don't want to deal with the Palestinians. The Palestinians have to vanish. There are, after 130 or 40 years of their activity, we, the Palestinians, are still 50% of the population in historical Palestine. And one day, within, let us say, I think within a decade, the number of Palestinians the world over, all over, would be more than the Jews all over the world. I mean, we are now 13, 14, they are 15, 16. Just give it 10 years and we will exceed them. And still, they don't want to see us. We have to vanish, to scream away, you know, to evaporate. And that's it. They want their own, the land. And not only this, they also want to control Egypt, to control Jordan, to hit Lebanon, to break Iran, to occupy Iraq, to steal the wealth of the Gulf, etc., etc. No kidding, no playing. And they say it just blank like that. No, no, they don't hide it. And see now what they are doing with Excellency Trump.
Can you talk about how important it is to, and I asked this a little while ago too, but can you talk a little bit more about how important it is to have this kind of documentation for the first time in English? Who is the audience that you're trying to reach with this book, and why is it so important right now?
The idea, in fact, to have it in English was of Fidesz. She has suggested that. After reading it for her own purposes, she wrote her memoirs, and she read the material, and then she came to me and said that this is a very important material, and I think we should translate it to English. I said, it's okay as far as I am concerned, it's okay, you can go on, and then she went on and so on. But I tell you something, I like it this way. I like the English, and I like this this edition. Because all over, there is a very big lie about the nature of Zionism. And all of them write about it, that it is, they even think that it is a national liberation movement, when in fact it is no more than a colonial movement. So for me, I just wanted something. In fact, once I suggested another a title for the book, An Alternative History of Zionism. But then I was told no, it's better not to have it, because in fact it is an alternative history. I wanted to expose or to, I mean, to introduce Zionism in its reality, not the way so many authors, everybody, you know, they, let's say, in fact, they forge. They, I mean, they, what they write is just a forgery. It's not right. As if the Jews all over their history were only longing and dreaming to return them to Palestine. And they were always Zionists, which is never true. Never, it was never true. One of the great Jewish historians, Professor Dovnov, who was killed during the Second World War, wrote a 12-volume history of the Jews, of Jews all over the world. He came with the conclusion, and he proved it, that the Jews were never a nation, neither Jews nor Zionism. They were religious communities living among various people, and all of their lives, since they were found up to that then, they always behaved as religious communities living among the Gentiles, no more, no less. And the notion that they are in a nation by itself and they were all the time dreaming to do a state, etc., etc., is not true at all. And that's why I like this book to appear in English so everybody can read it and see what exactly happened there.
Fida, do you want to jump in and talk about you know, your just what you learned? I mean, of course, you know, you grew up with your dad, you grew up with all of this history, you grew up in exile as well. What does it, and you've written about it in your memoir. Talk a little bit about your childhood and what it means to work with your dad at this stage in his life, now we're, you know, almost 78 years almost since the Nakba, and what this book has meant for you personally, but also what you hope it means kind of communally for Palestinians also in exile and for people in the English speaking world.
Thank you, Nora. The book to me was a real eye-opener. And I say that because, yes, as you kindly said, you know, growing up with my father, being exposed all the time to the Palestinian cause, also through his work, through even the community we were with, books and newspapers and things I found around me in the house. But really to come to such an in-depth understanding of Zionism and how it came about and the origins and really how it developed in the early stages was something that I, like many fellow Palestinians and many people who are even experts on this conflict, I doubt that they, you know, that they would know to this detail. Mm-hmm. Working with this book fulfilled several things. First, it really felt like a mission. My father, having completed all of this invaluable work, in my humble opinion, really needed to get out to the world and not remain confined to the spheres of history. Remember, these books are now almost half a century old that he wrote. So I thought we need to breathe life into them and to make it accessible to a wider audience, especially as the Palestinian issue and Zionism had really gotten to a point of such ferocious conflict that we're now really looking at, you know, back-breaking horrors, and that I felt this was a family contribution. This was my part and my father's part in bringing to light how this, in my opinion and in many people's opinion, terrible, you know, anti-Semitic movement came about, actually. It not only hurt the Jews, it hurt the Palestinians, it's hurting everyone in the region. We see the terrible consequences today. But it also, you know, in a family sense, it meant a lot because it was propagating my father's writings to the world. It was even, in a way, staying true to the memory of my mother, my late mother, who was killed during the war in Beirut when we were there, and who had actually helped my father with the sources for this book and with checking sections of it. And I remember when I started to read the second section and I saw my father had written to her, you know, it was dedicated to her. It came out after her untimely death. And he said, you know, who helped me so much with it, but was not destined to see it. So to me, it was really the closing of several circles, both for my people, for my family, for the public at large, for my cause. It really closed many circles at the same time.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, it's so deep and it's so layered, and it's so important to be able to articulate this history and, you know, really illustrate how Zionism has destroyed so much, and not just in terms of lives or in terms of land, but in terms of families and this intergenerational, multi-generational trauma and exile, and the trauma of being in exile. Sabri, if you can talk a little bit about your time in Beirut, when your children were young, as Fida said, your wife was killed by the Israelis. There, you know, you worked at the research center of the PLO. Talk about the Palestine Research Center, what your work looked like there in those days, and why the Israelis were so intent on destroying this history.
Look, this research center, I think it was the first, if not the first, the second Palestinian establishment that had to deal with the history of Palestine, to document it and to conduct research on it. Because before that, and since the Nakba, and even before the Nakba, there was no central, you know, Palestinian body or institute and so on that is dealing with the history of Palestine. So the PLO has decided that the time has come to do this thing, and then they did it. Now, I joined the center 5 or 6 years after it was established in 1965. It was established. I joined in 1973, just right after the October War. And I stayed as director there until the year 2004, when I retired after the death of the chairman, Arafat. We were doing, you know, I mean, very simple but basic work. We were conducting research on the Palestine question, and we were publishing it, and we were documenting the whole issues, the all of our cause. Then since 1971 and up to today, we are issuing the Palestine Affairs Shu'un Palestinia journal that, you know, it's a serious research publication that is accompanying the Palestinian cause from that for now about 36 years or something like that. We had published dozens of books, all kinds of books on all aspects of the Palestine question. And, you know, from time to time, we were hit, we were destroyed, we were killed, or, you know, all kind of thing. Then we had to stop working, and then we came again and again, to activity. Now the center is working almost fully in Ramallah, and it's going on, and it's becoming part of, the whole Palestinian, I would say, cultural organizations with the National Library and the National Archives, etc., etc. So what we did then, was a pioneering, we were just something like pioneers, especially in introducing Zionism and Israel to the Arab world and exposing really what is really Zionism without exaggeration, without falsifications, without, you know, any, I mean, mistake making, etc. Just exactly what is it? And I think we have done a good job, because I feel it in the press, in everyday life, in all comments of all Palestinians, almost every Palestinian intellectuals, more or less, they really know what is Zionism and what is Israel. And I think in this aspect, we really succeeded.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it wasn't just about also documenting, you know, what had happened in the past, but it was also about understanding what happened to you personally and what happened to 800,000 Palestinians who were expelled, what happened to the 160,000 Palestinians who remained and were put in, you know, under martial law, were expelled. Can you talk about your experience in the Nakba?
I had my own suffering. I had my own loss, okay? But in fact, every other Palestinian has lost and had suffered. I have seen the 1948 refugees passing through my village and go to Lebanon. I have seen them when I was 10 years old. I have seen the Arab villages destroyed. 5 or 6 Arab villages around Fasuta has vanished. And since that time, I have followed up and I considered all of the main, let's say, episodes of the Palestine question. Everybody almost. I don't think there is one single Palestinian family that didn't have some loss one way or another from this Zionist movement. Every family, all of them. All areas. In the West Bank, in Gaza, inside Israel, what called Israel now, 1948, okay. They are following even the Palestinians abroad and trying to kill them and prevent them from working, etc. You know it. I mean, they are criminals, just criminals. So, in fact, the fact that I had suffered something, I know it's difficult. It's, I mean, hurting and so on. But others also suffered the same. And I thought that in that what has was always driving me to do something good to help my people. And by the way, also helping these stupid Israelis to come down to logic and find a certain solution and to stop killing other people.
Tell us about Fasuta in those days before the Nakba. You were 10 years old when the Nakba happened. Tell us about what Fasuta was like.
Fasuta, compared with the other villages, was lucky, very lucky. In fact, it's not only Fasuta. It is more all of Western Galilee. This area where I am living in Fasuta, it's in the utmost northwest part of Palestine. We are just now about 2 kilometers away from the Lebanese border. Half an hour ago, there was such a barrage of shells that I couldn't believe it. I have never seen it before. I don't know why, what happened to them, and they were shelling Lebanon, okay? But what happened to Fasuta and to Western Galilee is that it was occupied at the end of the war, at the end of 1948. By that time, December 48, the Israelis were in a bad shape. Their state was a newborn, and the problem of the Palestinian refugees was, you know, pressing all over the Arab world. And Count Bernadotte, whom they have killed, whom they have assassinated, as proposed that the partition plan be abolished and have one single Palestinian state. And the Israelis got mad at that. And I think that's why they assassinated him. So, in fact, and even they write it in their literature, they didn't want any more refugees to come out of Galilee. And believe it or not, in all of the areas, they were surrounding the villages and leaving one single exit, either to Jordan or to Lebanon or to Syria. When they occupied Fasuta and the other parts of Galilee, first of all, they sealed the northern border. And believe it or not, they prevented people from going away. They retained all of the people because they didn't want any more refugees. And that's why up to now, out of the 73 or 74 villages and towns that were in the Acre sub-district before 1948, at least 67 of them or 68 are still existing. I mean, when I go now here, let us say, if I travel from here, from Fasuta, let us say to Nazareth, I pass on the road through 16 Arab towns. 16 Arab towns are on the road, and there are still more. Now, after that, they did some, some wrong things. They threw away, drove away the people of Ikrit, which is just to the north of us, 2 kilometers to the north of Daram, and some villages here and there. But in Western Galilee, that where I live, almost 90% of the inhabitants who were there before 1948 are still there, are still here. Now, we developed, we increased, we now constitute about 50% or even more of the population of the Acre sub-district. Okay, and if you come here, you can almost feel this is a mini Palestinian state. I mean, in my daily life, okay, roaming around, in fact, really, I don't need to deal with Israelis, neither with Jews. We have Palestinians who are engineers, doctors, lawyers, policemen, okay, garage owners, pharmacists, whatever you want. We are a small community living by itself. And we are flourishing and trying to do our best, despite, you know, all of the discrimination that they apply to us. Now, Fasuta was one among those villages. In fact, we suffered no casualties. Nobody was killed. We didn't lose too many lands because we really didn't have too many lands to be confiscated. And we are on a mountainous area, which the Jews don't like because they cannot establish settlements on it. So some small spots here and there, but we have no settlements, nothing. I mean, they just can't live here. And that's what we are going on. And it's so flawless that we have so many people like Fida here. We are 3,600 people in Fasuta. 1/10 of us are university graduates. We have about 350 university graduates in this small village. Okay? And 60% of them are women. Right? We have more women university graduates than men. And we are continuing to live, hoping that it would be better.
I love that, and I can't wait to visit. I don't know, Fida What does it mean to you to hear your dad of the Nakba generation talk about Fasuta as it was and as it remains now? Does this give you hope for, you know, at this time? I mean, you know, the region is on fire, as your dad was saying. There is a U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. It feels in so many ways like this is an existential war on all of these fronts. What gives you hope as a writer, as a translator, as someone who has grown up hearing these stories from your dad? Where do you find it right now?
It's a difficult question, Nora, because right now, perhaps I depend on my father a lot for the hope. When we speak very often about the situation, I like to hear his analysis of what's going on. It always gives a much more nuanced than the media, especially because I work in the media. So most of my work is just relaying the news as is. My father tends to give me the behind the scenes or the news, the bigger picture. I'd like to touch on one point that he spoke about when he said it's almost a mini Palestine. In a way, as heartening as that is, because it points to a story of survival against all odds, really, because of the sheer plethora of discriminatory and horribly repressive practices and laws and everything that people have endured for decades. So as heartening as it is as a story of survival, it's also very depressing in that even decades later, there is no integration among the Jews and the Palestinians in historic Palestine. In my own personal dealings, I have felt this. You know, you deal with each other with the minimum that's needed. You conduct your business, whether it's at the health center, the pharmacy, the national insurance, whatever you need to do, and then you go away. There are some pleasant exchanges and pleasantries and so on. But to talk about a real social integration, it doesn't exist. So on the one hand, it's heartening. On the other hand, it's very depressing, because here we are. And this takes us back to the nature of this book and to the reason we're having this discussion today. It all boils down to the nature of Zionism as a fundamentally exclusivist and supremacist move that doesn't want anybody else. And so try as we might, right? I wrote about this in my book also. We are expected to man the shawarma and the falafel stalls and do the hard work in the state that nobody wants to do, and then quietly disappear into our hamlets and not cause too much trouble after that. Hope at the moment for me is difficult, I will be honest, in a time where we are really, facing so much on so many levels. However, perhaps as you and I spoke, it feels like maybe this is the start of the big battle, which will eventually determine the course of Zionism, because it is impossible, it is simply unsustainable to continue as Israel is doing right now.
Thank you for that. Yes, these stories that play out, that it's become normalized to be an apartheid state. That's what Zionism encouraged. That's what it keeps encouraging. It is an exclusionary, exceptionalist state and ideology. Sabri, the same question to you. I don't know, about a year ago, time is like a very strange concept for me right now, but a year ago, well into the genocide of Gaza, historian Ilan Pappe said, this is the beginning of the end of Zionism. Do you share that analysis? Where do you think Zionism goes from here?
I hope it would be the beginning, of the end of Zionism. Okay? Because look, for example, there is something good that's happening, because that if you can say about genocide, it brings something good. And now the Israelis almost are not wanted in the Middle East. Egypt is not, although it had a peace treaty with them, for 2 years now, they have no ambassador in Israel, and they don't let an Israeli ambassador come to them. They don't want. Turkey, you know how much they love the Israelis. The Saudi Arabians, okay, have made it clear that they will have no recognitions and no Abraham records, and no peace treaty with Israel unless they accept the right of the Palestinians to establish a state. And Iran, you know what is happening now, I mean, between Iran and the other. In other words, nobody can bear Israel in the area. So they go around now, and they want to establish a, what call it to say, a pact, a deal, or a front with India. Look how much far away. With one Arab state, they don't mention it, but they, I think it is Morocco, which is also at the end of the Arab war. And they want to be friends with the Greeks and with Cyprus. And with these four countries that are scattered all over the world, they want to make an alliance. Because of their neighbors, nobody can bear them. And I hope this attitude would go on. And I hope the Iranians would break their necks and that of that, or one way or another, and get it rammed down. And then Israel by itself, I think it would reach a point that it had to come to reality and make peace with the others and recognize their rights. There is no other way. For years, we are offering them really a very reasonable solution. The thing of the two states, they are getting something like more than 2/3 of the area of Palestine, and this is not sufficient for them. They want everything. They want all of the Palestinians to go away, to control the West Bank and have the people there, you know, to be like slaves. It's not, I mean, it is not even a colony. It is worse than that. In colonies, there were something good for the people. The West Bank is worse than a colony. In Gaza, you know, it was a genocide. And up to now, they want from time to time to kill the Gazans and kill them and kill them and prevent them from going on. But my estimate, they are going towards the end of the road, and then they will reach the closed area. They cannot go further. Hopefully that would come very soon.
Finally, Fida, tell us about the book, where people can buy it. It's called The Foundations of Zionism. And Sabri, if you're going to be doing any speaking events about it.
We are trying to arrange events. In person, it's a little difficult, you know, especially as a lot of the interest is in the States and so on. So we are doing as many of these interviews as we can to get the word out to people. The book was published in London by Ebb Books. People can go on the Ebb Books website. It's EBB. There is a lot of links there to buy it from, or I always encourage people to buy it from the educational bookshop in Jerusalem, which actually ships worldwide. And it would be a great support to them because they are doing an amazing job in the conditions we're under. So I encourage that. And I do hope people will buy the book, will read it. It's a long read, but I humbly feel it's worth the time. And it really is an eye-opener to the origins, to the development, and to the ultimate way in which Zionism panned out and continues today.
Absolutely. And we'll put all of that information in the blog post that accompanies this podcast and in the show notes. It has been such an honor to have you both on, Ciudad Jirias and Sabri Jirias. Thank you both for all of your work and toward liberation always. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nora. It was great to speak with you today.
Thank you. Thank you. It is my honor. Thank you.